know, sort of enabled the South Pacific Islanders to enjoy this food that was just so intrinsically repulsive to this European guy. But really, it's not, you know, there's not a poi gene, there's not a Limburger cheese gene, there's not a natto gene, there's not a fish sauce gene. You know, it's just what you're used to. And I think we probably all can relate to the idea in the realm of cheese. I think we probably all can, you know, probably, you know, half of us or a third of us in this room love stinky cheese. And, you know, once in a while we'll go to a gourmet food store that sells a bunch of different cheeses and, you know, splurge on a chunk of really stinky cheese. We'll invite some friends over to share that with us. But guess what? Not all of our friends like that. You know, some people don't even want to be in the same room because they find the smell of it just so utterly offensive and they could never even consider putting it in their mouths. And, you know, the world is full of these foods that to, you know, a certain portion of the population, people who were raised around the food, is just like as good as it gets. And for, you know, people who are not familiar with it, it's just, you know, scary. It smells like death or rotting or, you know, something that's scary to them. Something else that I want to address, which Shoshi specifically expressed interest in, is the role of fermentation in ritual and religious iconography. You know, because the defining characteristic of fermentation is bubbles. When you set up a fermentation, you sort of watch it come to life. I mean, literally, it is coming to life. But that's been really understood in many indigenous cultures around the world as a very, you know, kind of magical event. You know, the introduction of life forces to the, you know, to whatever the, you know, liquid substrate usually that's being turned into an alcoholic beverage is. So there's, you know, lots of examples of, you know, cultures that had elaborate ritual around it. You know, in some cases, it was understood that people had to teach the ferment how to dance. So, you know, people would make a lot of noise and dance around it and basically, you know, teach it how to be active and do that until it got active. And then in some other places, they approached it in exactly the opposite way, where they felt like, you know, it needed to be undisturbed. It needed quiet and reverence. And so people would leave it alone and had a very different understanding of it. If you look at the pantheons of different pantheistic religions to which there is, you know, surviving documentation. I mean, in Egypt, there was a goddess of beer, Ninkasi. And in Lithuania, there was a god of pickles, Rogusi. Lots of pantheistic belief systems, you know, have some sort of specific god or goddesses or more than one of them. In Greek mythology, there was Bacchus, who was the god of wine. But, you know, even in our, you know, modern day, you know, monotheistic religions, in Islam, there's a prohibition on alcohol. In Judaism, we say a prayer, Borei Pari Hagafen, you know, blessed is the creator of the fruit of the vine. And we repeat it with, you know, multiple drinks of wine. And in the Roman Catholic Mass, you know, what is it that is, you know, transubstantiated from the blood of Jesus Christ? It's wine. So, you know, even in our, you know, contemporary monotheistic world religions, products of fermentation continue to have, you know, a really central place in our religious iconography. I want to mention one other aspect of culture, which is technology. The McDonald's brought this beautiful kraut shredding device, which you can see in the back of the room. That one that they have there is probably a 19th century shredding device. The desire for fermented foods and beverages has given rise to incredible amounts of innovation. Imagine the roots of pottery. I mean, you know, what greater incentive could there have been for people to develop the technology of ceramic vessels than to have vessels to ferment liquid in? So, you know, humans didn't invent fermentation. I mean, you know, there's lots of documentation of all sorts of animals being attracted to fermenting fruit, and even documentation of animals becoming inebriated from gorging on fermented fruit. And we can certainly, you know, surmise that our primate ancestors you know, in the African jungle, were, you know, occasionally enjoying the pleasures of, you know, gorging themselves with fermented fruit. But what's really the uniquely human achievement is, you know, figuring out how to make it happen. So you don't have to wait for it to spontaneously occur, you know, during those, you know, sort of, over-ripening moments when they do spontaneously occur. So, you know, so it's humans largely because we created vessels that could contain these things. Claude Lévi-Strauss, you know, who does lots of speculating about the origins of culture, has some interesting speculation about the origins of alcoholic beverages. And he basically calls, you know, a hollowed out tree that will hold water is like the transitional object from nature to culture. And I'm not sure I sort of like, I follow along with his argument the whole way, but this, you know, idea that it's a significant moment when people realize that rather than just sort of, you know, waiting to find, you know, a beehive of, filled with honey to wash out from a tree during a storm and sort of get diluted in a puddle and have someone taste it and say like, oh, that's really good. Oh, that's making me feel good. You know, when people began to intentionally do that, climb up in a tree and harvest the hive with honey, you know, find some sort of a vessel to place it in and dilute it with water, bring some intentionality to the process. So, you know, a lot of our technology that we've developed, you know, really has been in response to this, you know, this burning desire for fermented beverages and other types of products of fermentation. Now I just want to talk a little bit about my third theme, community. Microorganisms, as I mentioned earlier, like never exist in sort of, you know, singular, isolated species. You never find just yeast, Saccharomyces, like all on its own. You never find, you know, Lactobacillus just on its own. You know, microorganisms, like all other forms of life, you know, exist in communities with interactions. I think this is, it's a really important concept. I mean, the thrust of, you know, the literature of fermentation and the science of fermentation throughout the 20th century, you know, including the esteemed Dr. Steinkraus, has all been all about, you know, isolating individual organisms. And in many cases, it's been about, you know, how can we, you know, improve upon an indigenous practice that people have been doing and enjoying within their communities? How can we sort of look at what they've been doing and pull out the important organisms and then do that in a more hygienic way in a factory with more efficient production? And, you know, all around the world, you know, part of the process of, you know, cultures being destroyed and of cultural homogenization has been sort of, you know, killing off the, you know, indigenous community-based fermentation processes and moving these things into factory production, which, you know, has the result of, you know, disempowering people and breeding dependence on, you know, on a product that they have to buy that they previously had been able to create for themselves. Food and beverages brings people together. I mean, you know, when communities of people, when families, when any groups of people come together, it is most often around food. You know, food is one of the greatest community builders that there are. The process of growing food, transforming the raw products of agriculture into the foods that people actually like to eat, you know, these are all community activities. You know, there, we have this little myth of like total self-sufficiency. You know, sort of like our one family, you know, goes off into the woods and sort of, you know, creates a homestead, grows all of their own food, you know, mills their own grain, bakes their own bread, and that it's exactly a myth. I mean, it's impossible. I mean, you know, how can anyone do all of that on their own? We could have local food self-sufficiency, we could have regional food self-sufficiency, but it's got to be a community activity. You know, I mean, if it takes a village to raise a child, I mean, you know, what does it take to have a well-rounded diet? I mean, it takes lots of people doing lots of different things. And, you know, the fermentation arts are all extraordinarily simple at their basis. I mean, they're all ancient rituals that people have been doing forever. Or for a longer time than we know, because, you know, the origins of the ferments are not documented at all because they predate recorded history. They're prehistoric. The, you know, earliest written documents in different languages refer to the ferments that already existed in those traditions. But it's given rise to a huge amount of specialization. So, you know, I mean, any of us could, you know, learn how to brew beer. We could learn how to, you know, make some basic cheeses. We could learn how to make sauerkraut. You know, any of these, you know, very popular ferments. But it's not realistic that any one of us could do all of those things or learn how to do them all with any level of proficiency or do them regularly. So really, I mean, even when we're talking about reviving local production, I mean, we're talking about sort of, you know, rebuilding webs in our communities, webs of food production and webs of exchange. You know, in terms of the broader agenda that I'm interested in, which is, you know, reclaiming our food, bringing production, you know, back to earth, recreating alternatives to mass-produced foods. You know, since the Second World War, the development, you know, first in the U.S. and then the rest of, or most of the rest of the world following suit, has been centralizing production, mass production of food. As far as I can tell, the mass production of food has been a failure. We need to revive the ideas of regional and local production of food. It's been, you know, it's been a failure because, you know, it's producing nutritionally diminished food that's making us sick. Right now, for the first time in American history, demographers are thinking that our children's lifespans are likely to be shorter than ours, and one of the reasons for this is the, you know, diminished nutritional quality of the food that we're eating. The means by which we are mass producing food is, you know, polluting the earth, depleting water resources, polluting the water, creating new forms of pollution like genetic pollution that we don't really know how to deal with. The centralized production of food and the transportation of it, it uses a huge amount of energy. And, you know, as long as that energy is available and cheap, I mean, I guess there's thousands of products in every supermarket that we can buy, but, you know, that's a big if. Following the logic of, you know, peak oil and the idea that, you know, oil is becoming rarer and more expensive, both in monetary terms and in environmental terms, to extract from the earth. What are the implications of that on food prices and on food availability? And beyond the fuel involved in transporting food vast distances, there's the question of vulnerability to disruptions, all sorts of disruptions, whether it's from natural disasters or extreme weather events or, you know, wars or terrorism or other kinds of political violence. And basically being dependent on food resources far away makes us exceedingly vulnerable. So really, like, I think that, you know, for me, the big picture of why fermentation is important and why reskilling people with the ability to ferment food for themselves isn't so everybody can make everything for themselves, but it's so that it's because that's such an integral part of, you know, redeveloping community, local, regional food self-sufficiency. I mean, people don't just eat the raw products of agriculture. You know, people love to eat all the things that you turn the raw products of agriculture into. And these are largely fermented products.
And now we have a Q&A session. The recording of this is worse than that of the talk, so I've had to remove some, but I'd left others because it is really useful information and quite practical.
There are a lot of sort of industrially produced fermented foods. When you go to the Green Star and you see the kombucha that's sold all across the country. I don't personally think it's as good as the homemade stuff. I'm curious if there's a trade-off between ramping up production and maintaining the cultural integrity of the products?
Well, that is a great question. Okay, so some of you probably remember that maybe a year and a half ago, there was a big sort of scare about kombucha, and it was removed from the shelves of a lot of stores, most notably Whole Foods. And that was because, you know, I guess it was that the FDA sampled some bottles and found alcohol levels that were above 0.5%, which is the, you know, cutoff for foods or beverages to be marketed not as alcoholic beverages. So actually many people who were producing kombucha stopped using the, you know, sort of traditional culture for making kombucha, which is a kombucha kefir and a couple of other ferments are really notable for their cultures because their cultures have evolved into really distinctive physical forms. So if any of you have ever seen a mother of kombucha, it's this like rubbery disc that you know floats at the top of the sweet tea that it's fermenting. It begins as just a thin film, but it gets thicker and thicker. And I mean, I've seen them this thick, you know, floating on top of the sweet tea. So and that's it. And it's a community of organisms. It's called a SCOBY in the literature, S-C-O-B-Y, symbiotic community of bacteria and yeast. And so you know, this is what defines kombucha. Another SCOBY is kefir. It's a little, looks like a little florets of cauliflower. And they're called kefir grains or sometimes kefir curds. And similarly, it's a community of organisms. The kefir community has been much studied. Lynn Margulis identified more than 30 distinct microorganisms that are present in the kefir community. But you know, sometimes these SCOBYs are challenging for commercial production because it's very difficult to standardize. So you will not find a commercial kefir for sale in the United States that you know I think is worthy of being called kefir because they're not made with SCOBY, which is you know what has historically defined this food. Instead, you know, some microbiologists like looked under the microscope and you know sort of like pulled off a few of the organisms that are present in kefir, and so now kefir that's commercially available is a cultured milk product made with a few of the individual organisms that were extracted from kefir grains, but not with the full community because one of the organisms in the community in kefir is Saccharomyces cerevisiae yeast that transforms lactose into alcohol. When you're trying to sell a fermented milk product in a natural food store and market it for children, it becomes problematic if it has more than 0.5% alcohol. And you know, typically kefir will have, you know, 0.8% alcohol or maybe 1.1% alcohol. I mean, you would need to drink an awful lot of it to you know, feel the alcohol, but nonetheless, it is present. So it creates you know, huge regulatory challenges. Plus, your starter is something that keeps growing. So, you know, if you're trying to standardize production, have exactly the same length of time for each batch, if your starter keeps growing, it's really, really hard to standardize it. So basically the way people, at least in the United States context, have gotten around this is they've just extracted a few organisms from that. They call that, you know, kefir starter. You can buy different powdered kefir starters that I think it should be illegal to call kefir. I mean, they might be perfectly wonderful cultured milk products, but, you know, kefir is this, you know, community of organisms from the Caucasus Mountains that is, you know, sort of embodied in a physical form that has evolved. I mean, there have also been, you know, a multitude of experiments in laboratories where people take as many of these individual organisms as they can and then like put them together in a test tube and try to, you know, create a new life out of them and get and you know and create a new kefir brain and nobody's been able to do it. I mean, you know, it's like kefir begets kefir the way elephants beget elephants. And, you know, it's like nobody's been able to create it in a laboratory. But anyway, going back to kombucha, a lot of the kombucha manufacturers now, you know, because there's this sort of problem with alcohol in, you know, in the kombucha sometimes. I mean, really, as long as kombucha is exposed to air, alcohol doesn't accumulate. There's always going to be traces of alcohol, but because it's exposed to air, alcohol exposed to air turns into acetic acid. There are bacteria called Acetobacter that consume alcohol and transform it into acetic acid. But as soon as you seal it into a bottle, then you know there are yeast as part of that community that do produce alcohol. So when you seal it into a bottle and there's no longer a flow of oxygen, then you start to have greater potential for alcohol accumulation, and that's what happened with you know the ones that you know caused this big scare. But as a result, many of the manufacturers have ceased using the traditional kombucha culture, and instead are using you know various extracts of you know a few of the organisms
from the traditional kombucha culture, and leaving out the yeast and other ones that might be perceived as being problematic. So there are a lot of fermented foods that are being marketed that are really they have live cultures. It's not that they're bad things. It's just that they are not the things that they are purporting to be. They're not the things that sort of have historically defined those particular foods. So I think that there's that. And then there's also just, this is, fermented foods are like the ultimate in localism and the specificity of place. And I think that, cheeses are an especially good illustration of this because, all of these, kind of crazy different kinds of cheeses that exist. And, really what we can find in fancy cheese stores in the United States is, just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, a couple of years ago, I went to this international slow food gathering in Italy called Terra Madre, and one of the things that Slow Foods is doing is, sort of trying to promote and protect foods that are perceived as being at some risk of extinction. And so these really obscure cheeses, like I'd never seen before. I mean, there were cheeses where the sort of wrapping was the bark of a tree. There were cheeses where the wrapping was the skin of an animal. I mean, really just like extraordinary, range of styles of cheese making. But really, ultimately, they're defined by, the pastures on which different animals are grazing and the seasons in which they're being milked, and more than anything, by the environments in which they are being aged. And so, historically, specific cheeses were just produced in specific places. And, now in Europe, they have this sort of, legal mechanism for, protecting certain foods that, you can only use the name of the food in that particular place. But as a practical matter, there are all of these, sort of catalogs and, suppliers where you can buy all these different cheese cultures. And so, you can buy, the culture for a camembert. I mean, that evolved as a response to a specific set of environmental conditions. But now you can buy that culture and make cheese with it. And so, most cheesemakers are really trying to replicate certain classic styles of cheese, which is wonderful. I mean, the classic styles of cheese are great. But, because each cheese sort of evolved as a specific response to specific environment, there are lots of cheeses that are not being made because, a smaller and smaller group of them are the sort of popular cheeses that are being widely copied and manufactured and marketed. But there are many more cheeses that are not being copied and marketed. And so there's actually this very interesting woman, Marcelino is her last name. She's a cheesemaker who got interested in microbiology, got a PhD in microbiology. She's been basically writing about the loss of biodiversity in cheeses. So, as people are focused more and more on a limited number of cheeses and, sort of buying those specific cultures, there are all these other cheeses that are just falling by the wayside. And all these cultures, I mean, basically, fresh milk, as most of us grew up drinking it, I mean, it's a 20th century phenomenon. It's only possible to have, widespread enjoyment of fresh milk if you have widespread refrigeration. And so, really the origin of all cheeses is just the inevitable process of milk souring. And so, most people throughout history and most people still in the world, what the milk that they've had access to is sour milk. And there's been all this diversity of sour milks. And so we have a word in English that's become really kind of obsolete, clabbering, clabbered milk. And that really means, raw milk left out will acidify and thicken itself just through bacterial processes. But, clabbered milk in, different environments and different seasons will have very different kinds of flavors. And so when people had a clabbered milk that they especially liked, they would take a little bit of that sour milk and introduce that into the next batch of milk. And in the technical literature, that's called backslopping. We would take a little bit of the last batch and introduce that into the next batch, and that can be a continuous process. So all around the world, like everywhere where people domesticated ruminant animals for their milk, people drank sour milk, all these distinctive styles of sour milk developed. Now that yogurt has become this globalized process, I mean, basically the only vocabulary we have for talking about these is to refer to them as yogurts. So, you know, to use another slow food example, there's a fermented milk in a region of Kenya. It's very distinctive. It's always fermented in a gourd. They add the ash of a particular plant to it, as part of the process, and part of like creating a selective environment. And slow food is championing this, but they can only call it, like the only word they have is to call it is Kenyan yogurt. It has nothing to do with yogurt whatsoever. It's a different fermented milk. But you know, like all processes of cultural homogenization, like language is dying, everybody speaking a smaller number of languages, it's like the same thing is happening with these milks, where you know all of these distinctive styles of culture, sour, fermented milks are sort of falling by the wayside as more and more people are embracing the dominant global commodities like yogurt. And I mean yogurt, no disrespect by saying this. And you know, just another note on yogurt. You know, how many people here have ever tried to make yogurt? Okay, I mean, it's something that like a lot of people experiment with. And if you go buy a package of yogurt at the store, you know, buy plain, you know, Stonyfield, Dannon, whatever kind of yogurt, and you take a little scoop of that, you heat up your milk, you cool it down to 110, you introduce that milk, you create some sort of an incubation chamber to try to maintain it around 110 degrees for several hours. And you can make beautiful yogurt, and then out of that yogurt, you could make another batch of yogurt. But as you get into like the third batch and the fourth batch, like suddenly the yogurt's not staying so thick anymore. And it's just like with the kefir and the kombucha. You know, yogurt has been a community of organisms. And microbiologists at the Pasteur Institute at the beginning of the 20th century, you know, looked at yogurt under the microscope and decided, like, you know, this one, Lactobacillus bulgaricus, or this one, Streptococcus thermophilus, like these are, you know, the important bacteria for yogurt that make yogurt thicken, when there were lots of other bacteria there. So all of the commercial yogurts, starting with, you know, the Danone company in Barcelona in 1919, have been like making yogurt out of selected individual strains of bacteria. I mean, they combine a couple or two or three or four different bacteria, but that's not the same as an evolved community that has inherent stability and defense strategies to protect it from other kinds of bacteria and other, you know, forms of life that can attack bacteria. So these evolved communities have elaborate defense strategies. So traditional yogurts, you know, people got the culture from their, you know, grandmother who got it from her grandmother, and it just like passed down from generation to generation. When people try to make yogurt with contemporary supermarket yogurt, you can make wonderful yogurt for a generation or two, and then everybody has to go back to the store and buy another cup of yogurt to do another generation or two. So these traditional mixed cultures really are, you know, they're easier to propagate because they have this, there is this like community dynamics and community stability. And once we isolate individual organisms and, it can have practical benefit. You know, I'm sure for yogurt manufacturers, it's much more sort of consistent and predictable to work with, you know, a couple of isolated bacteria than to work with a community. But for people who are household or community level practitioners, it is ultimately a disempowering process because a generalist cannot isolate individual bacteria and propagate individual bacteria effectively. So now instead of being able to just continue propagating the culture received from, you know, your great-grandmother, you know, you have to keep on going and buying another starter. The whole thrust of, you know, fermentation science and fermentation literature throughout the 20th century and all about this, isolating individual organisms in the name of, you know, improved production. To me, it's exactly analogous to the process of, you know, hybrid seeds replacing seeds that farmers had saved over the course of generations that were well adapted to local conditions. You know. So, you know, that's been the thrust of the fermentation science and literature, you know, through the 20th century. And, you know, what my interest is and what, you know, the books that I've been writing are all about the opposite. We're trying to help empower people with skills to take back these processes and start doing them in their homes. And there are still heirloom yogurt cultures available. And, you know, the internet actually has turned out to be an amazing tool for spreading things like that around. So, you know, after years of occasionally making yogurt and then feeling discouraged when it stopped working after a couple of generations, a couple of years ago I got hold of an heirloom yogurt culture on the internet, culturesforhealth.com, and, you know, I estimate that I've done 45 generations so far with the same yogurt culture, and, you know, just each batch is just as, you know, thick and delicious as the previous batch was. In February, I had the opportunity to go to Indonesia, and I got to visit a village where they make tempeh. Now, I've been making tempeh for 15 years, and I always use a pure culture starter, Rhizopus oligosporus varsaito, which Dr. Steinkraus actually gave to the USDA. So there's a USDA culture collection, and it has this sort of, you know, one strain of Rhizopus oligosporus, and all of the tempeh that's been manufactured commercially in the United States has been made with this single strain. And, you know, I've, you know, sort of learned how to propagate the single strain, and it really, you know, kind of strains my abilities as a, you know, generalist without a laboratory to be able to propagate the single strain. I, you know, have to use a pressure cooker, and, you know, it's, you know, I have to, you know, kind of wipe down everything and just make sure things are, you know, as, I mean, obviously it's not sterile in my kitchen, but, you know, things are as sanitized as possible. And then, you know, I've had mixed results. Sometimes I get it, sometimes I don't. Usually I end up just buying my tempeh starter from a mail order source. But when I went to Indonesia, you know, what I found in this village where they make tempeh is like a leaf. They sandwiched some inoculated soybeans between two leaves. They over-ripened it, dried it in the sun. When they opened it up, you see two colors of sporulation. You see black, which is the color of the sporulation of Rhizopus oligosporus, and I saw yellow, which is the color of sporulation of Aspergillus food fungi, and then, you know, also just because it was in an open environment, there's all sorts of bacteria. And so, you know, you use that to inoculate the soybeans. You make beautiful tempeh that actually has like a more, you know, a more complex flavor to it. And then when you need more starter, you just take some of those inoculated soybeans, put them between two leaves, and it's easy for a generalist to propagate. And just, you know, conceptually, you know, for any ferment to be a sort of, you know, a continuous process, you know, from whatever its origins are to the present, you know, people didn't have microscopes, people didn't have sterile laboratories, people had to be able to propagate these things themselves. And whatever the improvements might be for commercial production to have isolated, pure cultures, they're not better for the home practitioner. You know, mixed cultures are much, much easier to work with because there's this like community stability that's kind of inherent in groups of organisms that have evolved together.
And that's where, because of the quality of the recording, I'm afraid I'm going to leave Sandor Katz. We conclude the show this week with a somewhat edited interview from 2014. Again, not perfect recording quality, I'm afraid. This is Dave Hamilton, British author, journalist, gardener and forager, co-author of The Self-Sufficient-ish Bible, an eco-living guide for the 21st century.
It is difficult if you're going to completely be self-sufficient. Yeah, you're not going to grow a field, especially with a half an acre or a small parcel, half an acre of wheat it's relatively tricky to transform yourself from a person who goes down to the local grocery store to someone who's providing for yourself. The transition town movement that we're starting here in Del Norte County in the States, that originated in Britain, of course, and we also have the Food is Free project. Are you involved with any formal movements like that across the pond?
No, I mean, I lived in Totnes for a while where the transition movement came about, and Rob Hopkins was sort of a near neighbour of mine. So as, in terms of formal movements, I try not to get involved. I know that sounds slightly wary. I quite happy did bits of work for them and worked alongside them. I'm in Somerset now, and I do chair the local gardening group. So in that sense, I am part of that, and I was part of Incredible Edibles Somerset, which is, I don't know if you've heard of the Incredible Edible movement.
I haven't.
It's a great thing. It was in sort of the north of England, a place called Todd Morgan. Two women got together and they tried to make every scrap of land available for food growing. So if you think of by a railway station, you might have a little scrap of grass. They put fruit trees on it, or next to a park, sort of a, or an office building. They had vegetables growing, and so I've been part of that here in Froome in Somerset. So there's some movements that I'll lean towards. I think they almost get eaten by themselves. It's good when they're sort of grassroots, small movements that link together. And then when things get too large, I think that's the point where I like to duck out.
So, Dave, why do you think this is gaining in popularity? Why are these movements surfacing, and why do you think your writing and your teaching is reaching an audience?
I think people are realizing that's the damage we're doing to the planet. And I think we're getting to a critical stage. And we really do need to do something about it. We can't rely on oil anymore. It's a finite resource, and we're still treating it like it's an infinite resource. And I think we need to sort of address our lifestyles. Like here in England, it's insane. It's apple season at the moment. You go into a local grocery store, a supermarket, and you can buy apples from New Zealand. Now, this is the other side of the globe. I can walk half a mile here and fill up two massive bags full of apples on a tree that was growing wild. No one else had touched it. They were left to just fall and rot. It's insane that we'd rather drive to a supermarket, fill our cars up with imported vegetables, and drive back again. And I don't think there's ever been a point in history where we would have done that. I think there's sort of the idiocy of what we're doing is becoming more apparent, and maybe people are wising up. I mean, that might sound incredibly arrogant, but I do think people are wising up and realizing that they can make simple changes that will make bigger differences in terms of society.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. And a little bit of education, even as you spoke to peak oil, that if you understand what peak oil is, even if some of the numbers are fudged and we are off by a few years or even a decade, if you understand the basics of peak oil, it means that everything is going to change. It means that our entire way of life, not only buying apples from New Zealand half or all the way on the other side of the planet, why that doesn't make sense, but everything, the oil that goes into the combines and the tractors and the packaging and the transportation, it means that if you only understand that, we are going to have to, and you can either react when things change drastically or slowly, or you can be forward-looking. And I really have an appreciation for people like yourself and myself that are forward-looking and trying to get ahead of the curve here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, so what if some of the numbers are slightly out? It's still, you know, it's still happening. And I always find that slightly confusing attitude. It's, you know, the skeptics quite often say, you might be wrong. There's not much at stake if the skeptics are right. Do you see what I mean? There's more at stake if the skeptics are wrong.
Yeah.
I can't see any other way than that. I know it took me a while to sort of forge that, but that's kind of the way I see that. It's sort of, why be skeptical about these 10 years, 20 years? Does it matter? We could have a much nicer lifestyle. You know, there's less pollution in the air. Surely that's better for everyone.
The worst that can happen if we start growing our own food and living self-sufficiently-ish is we have good, healthy, organic food that we are in touch with our food supply. We save a bunch of money. We probably develop a sense of community and a community with our natural surroundings. Those are the worst things that happen if we go, you know, plan B.
Yeah, so why are people fighting against that? So it's quite astounding, really. You know, are they fighting against people getting along and having fresh vegetables? It just sounds slightly crazy to me.
What are the lessons that you've learned from your work, Dave? Is it deep to you?
It's confirmed a lot of things, definitely, that they were probably already there. But I think I've always known the life most people live is quite damaging. And I've always just felt that my personal health and my mental health is always better when I'm spending time outside, when I'm growing food or I'm foraging or just going for a walk in nature. And the more I sort of enter this lifestyle, the happier I feel. I must admit, I've had since that last book was written, I moved towns, I sort of had to make new friends, and I've written a travel book. I'm just halfway through writing a travel book, that's a UK-based travel book. And I got out of growing, and I found I was slightly miserable doing that. And as soon as I get back into it, as soon as I get in touch with it, I'm happy again. And so my work teaches me what I should already know, I think.
Yeah, I think that living a so-called artificial lifestyle in cities and in technology, which, I mean, I still do, and I assume you do as well, there is a lack of satisfaction in there, and I agree. I personally look at growing food. It's like having a baby. It's like, you know, you plant this seed and you bring this life into the world and you nurture it. I mean, you don't eat babies, but it's just as magical and mystical as bringing a life into the world.
You are bringing a life into the world, and you can save those seeds and you can bring in the next generation of that life into the world. There is something magic about it. I think what got me, what I wasn't prepared for, was the first year that I really grew on any scale, was the sheer joy of it, was how excited I could be that my crop of corn had come up, or my tomatoes had worked that year, or digging up potato after potato, you know, just dropping one potato in the soil and then picking up 20 is just an amazing experience. And I think if anyone's got just a small scrap of land and they can just grow a small amount of food, the experience you get from that, the joy you get from just making your first meal that's completely from everything you've grown yourself, is unparalleled. I absolutely adored that moment, and that got me hooked. And I talk to people that are getting involved and doing the same thing themselves. They've just started a garden up, or they've just started an allotment, or volunteering on a farm, and they've had exactly the same thing. They've just had that first pot, that first soup, or that first salad. And it's just such a lovely experience. It's sort of hard to put into words. I just,
and it's empowering. Don't you find that it's empowering that we're, you know, we can be dependent on this artificial system, this industrial food supply, of which we have no idea where our food is coming from and how it's produced and what chemicals are in it, or we don't know anything about it. But growing our food not only has the satisfaction of knowing what we're putting into our bodies, but we are less dependent. I love an empowering principle.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly with that. Definitely. It's
now you're growing food. Is this urban gardening or are you rural?
I'm at the moment, and it's been a tricky year, as I've said, because I was writing a travel book, so I've had to grow things that haven't needed much care, which was a bit of a challenge in itself. So for dinner tonight, I had pumpkin that I grew. So it's a, you know, great crop you can just pop down. It spreads out, keeps the weeds down, and then you can grow things in between it. Yeah, I've had to sort of follow my own advice, really, and find ways of growing things, a very low-maintenance garden.
Myself and my partner and my small budding community, we have an off-grid wilderness forest farm. So we're way out in the national forest, and we're really engaging this experiment of self-sufficiency, and it's been an ongoing question. What is that life like? And if you're really self-sufficient, you know, an image comes up of a homesteader working 16 to 18 hours a day, strapped a plow to their own back and working their fingers to a bone. But as I'm getting closer to answering this question, Dave. I really don't think it's anything like that. We read a book by the Nearings, The Good Life. They settled into a life where they're working 4 hours a day. They call it their bread labor. And so it's 4 hours a day. And what a stark contrast that is to the standard 8-hour work day, which was originated there in Britain as well. Wasn't it a guy? Yeah. It was Robert Owen, right?
I mean, it was to do the mill workers, is that right? There's
Yeah, they were working 10 to 16 hours a day. There were child workers. It was real big in Britain, and he was the one that campaigned for the 8-hour work day. So that's the standard we have right now in the world. But what a difference. I mean, you think about being a farmer, that it's going to be this laborious, you know, life of chores. But maybe I'm interested to hear what your experience is with providing all of your own food. How many hours does it take?
Yeah, quite a lot.
So, okay, you blew me out of the water.
I think it's easier. It's easier in California, certainly. And I mean, I had a taste of that as near a taste as I could. It's growing under glass here. I mean, that's the nearest I'm going to get. So I had an agriculture-sized greenhouse to myself. And the work involved in that, as compared to an outdoor space, it was warmer, so things grew quicker. You could control the pest problem a lot easier. So if you had a polytunnel or a greenhouse, I think it would take out a lot of the drudgery. In California, you probably wouldn't need that so much. You've got the longer days and, you know, you've got more sunshine. You've got more sunshine out. It's dark. It's 6 o'clock. 6:30, it's dark now. It has been for an hour here. It's cold.
That's right. I forget you're in England. It's not known as the agricultural powerhouse of the world, is it?
It's not. No. Well, we've had frosts already. It's October and you know, it's getting cold at night.
People in America especially don't realize how far north Great Britain is. That Detroit, Michigan is right on the same latitude as Rome. And you're way up by the North Pole, essentially.
Yeah, we're more sort of in line with Canada. But we have the Gulf Stream, so that does warm things up.
Yes.
So, you know, tropical waters that come over from Mexico, essentially. Let's go back to your question. So, really, I think if you work as a community, it seems to bring the work down. If you're working as an individual, I think if there's that attitude of working by yourself to keep yourself sufficient, I think it's a lot harder. I think you're getting into drudgery. If you're trying to just keep yourself and maybe your family fed, then it's going to be a lot more work than if you're working as a community, which, you know, kind of makes sense. If communities work together and grow different things and maybe barter vegetables and fruit with each other.
Now, have you been involved in developing a food forest of site, or is this?
I worked at a place called Schumacher College and tended to the forest garden there. It does bring the work down. I think there's a sort of slight fallacy that a forest garden is no work. It's not. There's still work involved. There's still a certain amount of maintenance that needs to be done. It's a lot less than an intensive agricultural system, but there's still a certain amount of work that needs to be done. I think if, you know, community-based and you do things like forest gardening, so you've got weed-suppressing plants. Weeding takes a hell of a lot of time. Weed-suppressing plants or weed-suppressing material, can even be straw, helps. If you're growing, say, a field of carrots and you're having to weed it every 3 weeks or so, then that's intensive farming. And that's one of the reasons why organic carrots are so much more than non-organic in this country. So I think it depends on what you grow. It depends on how many of you there are. It depends on your climate. So if you're in a cold country and you're working on your own, it's going to be drudgery.
Yeah.
If you're in a warm climate and you're in a community, I think it's, you're going to lower the hours. And if it's, you're growing sort of more of a forest garden way, then you're lowering the hours as well. So I love tables and graphs. I'll have to draw a graph, I guess, of temperature and hours in.
Yeah, I'd like to see your graph. Send it to me if you create that. So let's get to your book here, Dave. Grow Your Food for Free, Well, Almost. What spurred this on?
This is really my method of gardening. This is sort of in 80,000 words or whatever. Well, I think it's 80,000, this one.
Now, this is your method of gardening by yourself in a greenhouse in the cold, right?
Yes.
In the dark.
Yes. I mean, there are some nods towards warmer climates in there. I've got things about water saving and there are some bits that were sort of inspired by friends in Australia, similar climate to yourself. But yes, this is cold gardening. You see, there's pictures in there of gardening in the snow and you know, The book was wrapped up in a very cold February. I remember sending the last edits in February, and it was pretty cold.
Perfect.
It's a way of gardening. So, I mean, the title is slightly misleading in a sense. It is about food growing, but it's about the infrastructure of food growing. So it's your compost bins, your paths, and making sheds and greenhouses, and doing that on a very low budget. So it's saving... do you have skips in America? You have big metal containers that people throw their rubbish in when they're doing building work. You're bound to have them, but we might call them something different.
What you call it, a skip?
We call it a skip. What do you call it there?
Dumpster. That's what we call it, is a dumpster.
A dumpster. So there's bits about dumpster diving for wood and for, you know, materials to use in the garden. So, which is something I did, and I also visited wood recycling projects. So there's a, if you're not so keen on dumpster diving, there's other ways of getting secondhand materials. So it's about reusing materials in the garden. I think studying the natural world, you know, you study the natural world teaches us a lot, you know, as much as any formal education, that just being in nature is a way of studying in itself, of following what the seasons do and seeing what changes from year to year. And I think especially for over the last 10, 20, 30 years, I've seen shifts, I've seen things change. So I think definitely the natural world can teach us a lot more than we realize.
As you became a student, you began growing your own food. Can you tell us, why did you start doing that?
I was inspired by a guy called John Seymour. I don't know if he made it over to America. He wrote the Self-Sufficiency Bible. I didn't know part why my book was called the Self-Sufficient-ish Bible. It was a book that was around the 70s. It was a response to the oil crisis in the 70s. So a lot of people went into growing their own food back then because what I believed as they do now, and is very real thing happening, that oil is running out. We are reaching an end of oil. The oil prices shot up in the 70s, and John Seymour wrote this book. Read this book, and it would have been then late 90s, early 2000s. I was very inspired and wanted to do just the same. I wanted my own farm. I wanted to be self-sufficient. And then I realized I couldn't do it on a mass scale. He's talking about acres. You know, he's talking about a large scale. And I really wanted to do that in a much more confined space. I was living in Oxford. I had an allotment, which is just a sort of allotted piece of land, a small piece of land, and a back garden. So really not much land at all in terms of square feet. And so I squeezed everything I could onto that land and decided that the best thing to do wasn't to become self-sufficient, because it was impossible to become self-sufficient-ish. So I grew as much as I could. So I basically saw my own limitations. So I saw that things like your grain, so your pasta, your rice, I couldn't grow those very easily. I couldn't grow the wheat and the rice, but I could grow everything else.
Right.
So for a year, I experimented and I wanted to put something on the table that I'd grown myself or forage. And I managed it for an entire year. All my vegetables and all my fruit was either foraged or grown myself in just a very small amount of land. And it was a great experiment. And then that's what sort of inspired the website and then inspired the books. It's amazing when you put your mind to it, what you can grow in a very confined space.
Yeah, I just visited a small farm locally here that has a half an acre. And It was amazing what they produced in a half an acre. I live on much more land, and I think they outproduce me. And I like that you recognize the difficulty in transitioning into full self-sufficiency. And, of course, you coined the term self-sufficient. I have a hard time with that word.
Self-sufficient-ish. No,
self-sufficient-ish. What advice do you have for people who are really new to gardening and they have never grown a tomato and they don't know how to get started? Besides buying your book, what advice do you have for them?
Of course, buying the book, Don't be afraid to get it wrong is a big one, is that you learn from your mistakes. And, you know, big deal if this plant doesn't work this year. Hopefully you've learned from that experience and the next year you can grow something. I think start with easier things. People often start with tomatoes. Tomatoes aren't necessarily the easiest thing to grow. A lot of times we will grow, you know, a few different tomatoes and they'll be killed off by blight over here quite often. I'm not sure what would affect them quite so much in America, but it's certain diseases that tomatoes get and they can be slightly harder to grow. So maybe grow a squash, you know, a pumpkin. They're very easy to grow. soil is something often neglected. Make sure your soil is well fed. So good compost down, good animal manure worked in, and do that now. If you're planting in the spring, do that now. Do that in November, December, and then plant out in the spring. Don't be afraid to get it wrong. Start on easier things. Salads are quite a good thing to start on as well. And that can be grown indoors. I've grown a lettuce on a windowsill. You know, a single pot, a couple of seeds in, the lettuce came up. And it's a great way of growing when you're living in an apartment block. So you might not have access to a garden. It doesn't mean you can't grow. A window box with herbs in, or you can have a window box with salads and, you know, there's small crops, radishes. I'm trying to think of the translations here. You know, you're beetroot, do you have a beetroot?
Beets, yeah, beetroot, yeah.
Yeah, beets, yeah, beets and chard are good things to grow in a window box.
I want to back you up on your first point of not being afraid to make mistakes. We just recently visited a gentleman who's been teaching and practicing permaculture, food forest principles. We went to his farm and he gave a presentation. One of the things I learned from him inadvertently was he would go around showing us all of his mistakes. Well, I planted a tree here, but it wasn't the right place. So we found out that there's this wind and humidity that's not good for a tree in this position. And then he would go to another place. And this is somebody who's been doing it for 30 years who was completely okay. In fact, he really highlighted that it was a part of the process that you cannot know everything. Every climate is different and every situation is different, whether it's the temperatures or the soil. And so it is an experiment, and it's really okay, in fact, beneficial to make mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because you know it's better to get it wrong in order to get it right the next time than everything to go swimmingly right, and then you get lulled into a false sense of security, and then the next year you do exactly the same thing and everything fails and you've got no idea why. You know, it's much better to get the odd thing wrong, to have the odd tree leaning the wrong way because it's not quite in the light, or your salad crop's failing because there's not enough nitrogen in the soil. And then you realize, okay, I need to address this problem. Didn't think about this problem before. And then that enables you to grow other crops a little bit better. So yeah, absolutely. Good on him.
Well, thank you very much, Dave, for your time and your energy and your work towards building a more sustainable-ish future. And I wish you the best of luck. There's not a rider from the east to the west to hold you alive in this darkness and midnight. But the potbelly.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. I'm currently looking for help to produce a future episode. I want to adapt a video, but it's got a lot of different readings that need to be done with different voices. It doesn't matter whether you're a native English speaker or not. What's important is that you have a clear voice, that you're interested in helping with the show, and that you have some time and a microphone, and you can record an MP3 and send it my way. If that is appealing to you, you can get in touch at unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net, and that email is also valid for making comments about the show or suggesting new material to me. Although I don't myself, it's a great thing to be surrounded by people who do grow the majority of their own food, where processed, imported food is looked upon as an optional extra, a luxury item rather than a staple. Something in Ivan Illich's enigmatic opening statement spoke to me about the contrast between life here, thriving, living, local, community-based, grounded existence, so disparagingly referred to as underdeveloped by the professionally trained experts from the sterile West, concrete surrounded, abstracted, rich in money terms, but poor in so many other ways. I hope this show has inspired you to return to Earth, to seek out those acts which to seek to discover and to carry out those acts which are virtuous, those acts which nurture the lives of those around you, human and non-human, microbe and non-microbe.